Bring the War Home, which has been a rallying cry of the anti-Vietnam War movement, was transformed on May 4th, 1970 into irony when the Ohio National Guard opened fire on student anti-war protests at Kent State, killing 4 and wounding 9. Columnist Bill Newman says many, certainly not all, of the anti-war student activists were privileged white men. Those cadres of the movement got a lot wrong then, but as the LGBT, environmental, and anti-war movements that followed have proven, they also had some core beliefs that were right. Bill Newman has been director of the Western Massachusetts Office of the American Civil Liberties Union for more than a quarter of a century. He has put together a new book of his columns and writings entitled When the War Came Home, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Bill Newman to the roundtable this morning.
Thank you very much. To be here. Thanks.
Thank you very much for being here. I was fascinated in the book. You make the point in the book that some of these pieces you edited a lot. Some of them you did not. I would think, as time goes on, when you go back and look at your work, especially writing about such a pivotal and turbulent period, that it must be interesting to see what time has done to these various pieces.
I think that's true. And the book really came about because 10 to 20 years ago, I wrote a monthly column for my local newspaper. And when I was asked to come back and write it again, I went back to read those columns. I also read some magazine pieces that I'd written around that time and a piece that I'd written for the Massachusetts Review as well. And when I came to trying to figure out what worked, which was the reason for rereading the pieces, I actually found something else, which was I could have written about half of those pieces that week, that day, that month. And I said, why? So the question became, why do things last as opposed to what kind of writing works? And what I discovered is that in the writing, there is this core and seminal connection to the anti-Vietnam movement, war movement, and the beliefs that we held at that time. And when the war came on, which was a magazine piece originally, it did go on undergo significant editing for this book. Nonetheless, that became, of course, the theme of the book. And what I also found was the notion that although we will fail, my generation will fail to achieve those goals, the next generation and the generation that follow really might.
Why do you think that is? You talk about those core beliefs that especially, because I could sum up what you just said in why don't we learn from history? Why don't we learn from our mistakes? Why don't we learn from even our successes?
Well, I think that's true, but I think that more than that, I think that if you look at some of these sociological studies, and we did them when we were doing jury challenges in Massachusetts back some 20, 30 years ago, and we found out that there is, in fact, a group of people who were of college age between 1964 and 1974, and they actually have a different belief system, significantly different from the people who came before them and the people who came after them. It's not dependent on being in college. It was dependent on being of that age at that time and the sense that we could fight for equality, we could fight for human rights, we could fight against the war, we could fight for the environment, we could fight for freedom. And these became, I think, really imbued in us as guiding lights.
The operative word there being, to me, fighting. What I see now is less of a fight in us, less of a fire, if you will, to go out and try to change these things.
Well, I think that is also true. I'd say when there's the wars, where are the people in the streets? What about climate change? Why aren't people outraged? I mean, utterly outraged about what we're doing. When we talk about the degradation to the world, both spiritually and environmentally, why aren't people in the streets more? And I think that's a good point. I think there has been some pacification of the spirit. Nonetheless, I think that when you look at the LGBT movement, when you look at, for example, marriage equality, when you look at the fight and the climate change march in New York City just a month or so ago, the spirit lives on. The fight does live on. It may have transformed itself. We're a little older, we're a little punchier, a little grayer, but the fight goes on.
The fight goes on for those people, but what about the new generations and the kids of today replicating the kids of 40, 50 years ago?
I don't think they want to replicate. I want to think they want to have their own fights. They want to have their own spirit. And I see in the college kids that there is a lot of fight in that age group. And the idea, for example, that there should be equality for gays and lesbians, which was really radical in our time, in my time as a college student, is something that's just accepted now. The notion, if you talk to younger people in this younger generation and say, is there a question about equality? They'll look at you like you came from the far side of Mars. So that there, in fact, has been a significant change, and I think significant movement towards a more egalitarian, fairer, better world.
I don't want to argue with you on that point, because I think that I think you're right in the sense that there are many students, there are many young people out there who do want to fight, and yet you do not see them the same displays, and goodness, you don't even see them go out and vote.
That's true. And I think I rail against 40 to 50% voter participation. It does make me crazy that people will not participate.
Which, by the way, isn't just on the shoulders of young people. It's on everyone.
Although older voters vote more.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, that's true. But it is it's a universal problem, and I guess I'm curious as to how you view that. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Mentality that seems to be waning, where we're like, all right, well, I have to worry about what, you know, my own problems.
Well, I think first there's an economic reality, which was not true in the 60s. When I went to college, I didn't actually worry about how or could I get a job when I graduated. I was pretty sure there was going to be a job. I didn't know what it would be, but there would be a job. And I felt the same way when I went to law school. There would be a job. I kind of, in third year of law school, forgot that part when you're supposed to apply for a job for the next year. I actually didn't do that, and I ended up on the Menominee Indian Reservation for a while and then moved back to Western Massachusetts. But I think there's an economic reality here, that students in college now have to worry about how they are going to support themselves, how they are going to deal with massive student debt and the like. That was something that most of us, or many of us anyway, did not have to worry about in the 1960s and the early 1970s. So that has changed. But I still think that they feel deeply these grievances that I've articulated and I write about in the book.
You do start off the book by writing about Kent State. What was it about? What kind of turning point was that for you and do you think for the movement, if you will?
I think Kent State really mattered because it took a slogan, bring the war home, and it ironically really showed that the war had come home. We said, they're going to kill college students. They're going to get out there with their guns and they're going to kill us. And I got to tell you, when I said it, I didn't really believe it. I kind of thought maybe it was possible, but I didn't really believe it. And then 3 hours up the road from where I was in college in Yellow Springs, Ohio, they did it. They did it. They opened fire on innocent anti-war protesters on the Kent State campus, and they killed them. And then they covered it up. And then they said officially it was fine for the National Guard to kill those kids because there was a sniper. Well, there actually wasn't a sniper, but we'll say there was a sniper, even though that there wasn't. And somehow it's just fine for the National Guard to kill the kids. But could you have imagined then what would have happened if the anti-war protesters had killed some National Guardsmen?
Mm. You write a lot in the book about friends who served in the war. And so on this Veterans Day, I'm interested in your thoughts and in what you have learned from those friends who served.
What I've learned mostly is really personal. I don't think I could have done and served and survived the way they did. They came back and made lives for themselves. They went through experiences that I can only imagine, that I know how hard those experiences are to talk about. I can imagine what it was like in those rice paddies. I can imagine what it was like, and I may see my friend every time the helicopters come over, and he kind of cowers because of what that means to him and what he experiences every time. You had guests on earlier today talking about how the experience of war lives forever in a person.
Right.
And I think that's true, and I see it. And I have enormous respect for those who served. And I wish I had had that same respect during the Vietnam War.
You quote Tim O'Brien in the book as they all carried ghosts, which can be taken many different ways, and certainly I think you can play it out in that in that manner. For you, in writing, as you said, you could be writing in some of these pieces, you could be writing about today, you could be writing about what is happening right at this moment and right now, and those core beliefs. I don't have any other nicer way of asking you this other than, don't you find that depressing?
Yes and no. I find it really depressing that we are in a state of politics where the Republicans can carry the midterm election standing for absolutely nothing except that we really hate Obama and vote for us. I mean, I find that really distressing. I find it distressing, the racism that came to the fore after Barack Obama was elected president, and that I think still plays out in our national politics. I find it really depressing that we have war after war after war, and we are unable to stop it, notwithstanding that the United States government invented the reasons for this war. We didn't have to spend. We're talking about spending $3 trillion, $3 trillion to pay for Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah, that's all really depressing. I don't take a Pollyannish attitude about this, but I do think that the politicians are not going to lead. I think the people ultimately will lead. And I do see this possibility of a movement of people, both from the right and the left and the center, who say, really, I am mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore, and I don't want the government in my life and in the ways that it is imposing itself. And I think there is a possibility of a people's movement. I still hold the fourth, that there is that possibility and that it can succeed.
I mentioned, or you mentioned it earlier, and it struck me because it seems in talking to other people about this issue of citizen involvement and what it's going to take people to get that upset is over climate change. That could be the issue.
I think that's right. Look at what Interstellar, the movie I saw over the weekend. I think it's going to engender a nationwide discussion about climate change more than has already happened. The United Nations report that came out a few weeks ago says we are at the precipice. This is a desperate time. We have to take action. There's no more time to waste. We can't fool around. I think that to the extent that people say our lives are at stake, our children and our grandchildren not only will not have the economic opportunities we have, they won't have the political freedoms we have, they may not have the earth that we have to live on. And I think that to the extent that that permeates our consciousness, that climate change movement can in fact and may in fact galvanize the citizenry to real action.
You mentioned this a moment ago about the midterm elections. However, during the exit polling, even though there was that report from the UN, which followed a report from the Pentagon, of all places, of talking about how this was a national security issue, climate change, that yet it wasn't much of a blip on people's radar when at the polling and the exit poll.
Life changes quickly, and consciousness changes quickly. And I think that to the extent that the media is complacent about this issue, the media bears some of the blame. That said, I think that there are enough extreme weather events. There's enough on the news. There's enough that people are seeing personally to say, look, we've got flooding in New York. We've got flooding in Miami. We have these torrential storms that are destroying parts of the world. A few more Katrinas in the United States, and there will be that change.
As director of the Western Massachusetts office of the ACLU, how have you seen, you've been doing this for, as I said, over a quarter of a century, how has that fight changed, do you think, over time? How has that job, your goals changed over time?
I don't think the goals have changed. I think that the fights changed somewhat. For example, and I do write about this case in the book, I was co-counsel on the first lesbian custody case in Massachusetts, which, of course, over the years has been used as precedent and eventually was used in Massachusetts as the rationale or part of the rationale for the marriage equality case. And, of course, Massachusetts was the first state in the nation to have a declaration that under our state constitution, marriage equality is a constitutional right. So I think that some of the fights have been somewhat won. But police brutality, that fight still goes on. The fight for freedom of speech, to say that people have the right to, for example, record police officers performing their public duties in public spaces, that fight still goes on, notwithstanding the court says that we have that right. The right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures is a bigger fight now because of the national security state that has evolved over the past 25 years due to the Patriot Act and other federal laws. So I think the fights change. I think the fundamental values at stake and the fight for them remains exactly the same.
Were you, I don't know if you were referring to this specifically, but the case in Saratoga Springs with the officer, have you seen that video?
I have seen the video, and we have had a number of people on my radio show actually talking about it.
So what do you think? I mean, what would a position of the ACLU...
You mean, you're talking about the one this just in the last day
yes,
or two?
Oh,
I'm
yes.
sorry. No, I have not had people on talking about that. But I think that it is absolutely the citizen's right and a First Amendment right to record police officers performing their public duty. And it, in fact, has been significant in terms of not only encouraging, but in fact, changing police behavior. So, in fact, there is less police abuse. It is the fact that they may be recorded that, in fact, stop some officers. And there are really some really good police officers out there. But there are some who abuse their authority and they beat people up and they hit people and they hurt people and they shoot people. And the fact that they may be recorded doing that makes us safer from those police officers. It is a boon to the citizenry that there is this declaration, and has been over the past few years, a declaration of a First Amendment right to record those police officers performing their public duties. It makes us safer from those bad cops. And it also gives, I think, encouragement to all those many, many fine police officers and law enforcement officers who obey the law, who say, that's wrong. And they can say, hey, it's wrong. And by the way, you may get caught.
Bill Newman is the author of the book When the War Came Home, and the book is out. It's a very cool collection. It's Levelers Press, is that correct?
It is.
And you can find out more. It's Bill Newman's When the War Came Home. Bill, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank
and
you very
much. And a
pleasure
to be here. Thanks so much.
Very nice to have you here. Bill Newman's new book is When the War Came Home. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.